Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine you are a highly visible public figure,
Right.
and you're facing literally life-threatening opposition from the most powerful authorities in your country. Like, the tension is at an absolute breaking point.
It's a total pressure cooker.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, do you issue a clear press release? Do you, go on the defensive and argue your case plainly?
You'd think so.
No. You suddenly pivot and start speaking entirely in complex, coded riddles in public.
Which is just wild.
It really is. And that is the jarring, dramatic shift we are unpacking today in our deep dive into Matthew chapter 13. Because if you're listening to this on your commute, or maybe you grew up hearing these stories, you probably think of this text as, I don't know, a collection of quaint, peaceful agricultural metaphors.
Yeah, like a farmer planting seeds, a mustard bush, some yeast and dough.
Right. It all sounds very pastoral, very nice. But our mission today, based on a really fascinating prep document and some rich historical summaries, is to totally shatter that misconception. We are going to uncover the absolute pressure cooker of first-century political tension, crushing economic realities, and intense drama hidden right beneath the surface of this text.
And that pivot to speaking in code is what completely baffles people if they don't understand the historical context.
Yeah.
We tend to read these seven parables: the sower, the weeds among the wheat, the mustard seed, the yeast, the hidden treasure, the pearl of great price, and the net. We read them as if they were just like nice moral fables spoken into a vacuum.
Right, like it's a Sunday school lesson.
Exactly. But first century Judea and Galilee were the absolute opposite of a vacuum. The events of this chapter are the direct, explosive fallout of what had just happened in the preceding chapters.
Right, because the source text makes it clear that the religious authorities hadn't just, disagreed with Jesus.
No, they cross a massive line.
A dangerous line. They leveled an unpardonable accusation against him, attributing his miracles directly to Beelzebub.
Or Satan.
Right, Satan.
Which means the spiritual warfare had reached a fever pitch. You really have to understand the mechanism of that accusation in the first century.
How so?
Well, attributing someone's power to Satan isn't just a theological insult. It is the ultimate delegitimization strategy.
Oh, I see.
If the entrenched religious elite can convince the crowds that this traveling rabbi is empowered by demonic forces, his entire movement crumbles. I mean, it is a legal and spiritual death sentence.
Wait, I'm still stuck on this though. And I think it's where a lot of people reading this text get confused.
Okay.
If someone publicly accuses you of working for the devil and your life and mission are literally on the line, why switch your pedagogy?
Yeah, the timing seems weird.
Right. Speaking in poetry and talking about farming feels like career suicide in that moment. Why not just argue back with maximum clarity?
What's fascinating here is that the parables were actually a brilliant tactical shift. Yeah, they weren't a defensive retreat at all. In response to this unpardonable hostility, Jesus altered his teaching method as an act of theological condemnation against the elite.
Theological condemnation.
Exactly. Think of the parables less like a riddle and more like an acoustic dog whistle.
Oh, wow.
They were broadcasted at a specific frequency that accomplished two entirely different things simultaneously. To the humble, broken, and receptive hearts, the message came through perfectly clear. It revealed divine truth.
But to the authorities.
To the arrogant, hostile authorities, it was designed to sound like meaningless, frustrating static.
So he is intentionally standing in front of the very people trying to destroy him and speaking a language they fundamentally cannot decode while handing the truth directly to the people who are actually listening.
Yes, and our source document highlights a critical piece of text to prove exactly that. Jesus literally pulls his disciples aside away from the crowds to explain the hidden meanings. He says to them in Matthew 13, verses 11 and 12, and I'll quote it here, "Because the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you, but not to them. Whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them."
But not to them.
Yeah.
That is just, it's chilling when you really internalize the context. He is rendering the highly educated authorities completely in the dark, entirely because their own arrogance blocks them from decoding the message.
It is a profound inversion of the expected power dynamic. The elite are locked out, and the uneducated peasants are handed the literal secrets of the kingdom.
And here's where it gets really interesting. This theological code wasn't just designed to lock the elite out.
Right.
It was designed to let a very specific, desperate group of people in. To understand why this coded message was so explosive, we have to look at who was actually standing in that crowd receiving it.
The peasants.
Right. This wasn't just a theological puzzle for them. It was a promise of deliverance landing directly in the lap of an economically devastated people.
Devastated is almost an understatement.
Yeah, I was looking at the historical notes on Galilee at this time, and it is staggering. These people weren't just poor, they were suffocated.
You absolutely cannot separate the spiritual message of Matthew 13 from the physical, economic reality those crowds were enduring.
No.
As an impartial historical observation, the crowds listening to Jesus lived on the razor's edge of starvation. They were under the oppressive rule of Herod Antipas.
Right.
And they worked these tiny plots of land that they largely didn't even own because the land was being bought up by absentee landlords.
And our prep document details how they were crushed by layered taxation. Mm. It wasn't just one tax.
Oh, no. It was relentless.
First, you have the temple tithe.
Mm.
Then you get hit with the Herodian tribute. And then, on top of all of that, the Roman vectigalia.
The vectigalia, yeah.
I have to be honest, I didn't even know what vectigalia meant before looking at the sources. Can you break down how that actually functioned on the ground?
Yeah, it's vital to understand the mechanism of that specific tax. The vectigalia wasn't just a standard modern sales tax where, you know, you pay a few extra cents at the market.
Like we do today.
Right. It was an aggressive physical extraction of agricultural goods. The Romans were literally taking a massive percentage of the grain and produce right out of the carts before the farmers could even feed their own families.
Wow.
Let alone sell it to survive.
Uh-huh.
It was layer upon layer of systematic wealth extraction from people who barely had enough to eat.
So put yourself in the shoes of that peasant farmer. You are starving, your grain is being seized by Rome, and Jesus stands up and tells the parable of the sower.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at Matthew 13.23. Jesus says, "But the seed falling on good soil refers to someone who hears the word and understands it. This is the one who produces a crop yielding 160 or 30 times what was sown."
100-fold.
Yeah. When I read that, I tried to contextualize the math. Historically, a fantastic bumper crop yield in first century Galilee was maybe 7-fold.
If they were extremely lucky.
Right. So hearing about a 100-fold harvest isn't like getting a nice 5% raise at your corporate job.
Not even close. To a crowd accustomed to scraping by on a 7-fold yield, a 100-fold return completely breaks the scale of reality.
It's like winning a cosmic lottery that instantly pays off your mortgage, completely abolishes all of your taxes, and frees your entire town from crippling generational debt.
Exactly.
It is an unimaginable number to them.
That analogy hits the nail on the head. In an economy designed to suffocate them, a 100-fold yield represented absolute miraculous deliverance from economic oppression and tyranny.
Wow.
Jesus wasn't just giving them quaint advice on how to plant seeds. He was promising a reality so abundant that the current oppressive systems of Herod and Rome suddenly looked incredibly small.
And fragile.
Right. The magnitude of that promise would have sent an absolute shockwave through that crowd.
But promising that level of miraculous deliverance to a desperate, starving crowd is incredibly dangerous, especially when the powers that be, and frankly, a lot of the peasants in that crowd, are actively looking for a completely different kind of revolution.
Extremely dangerous. And this leads right into the apocalyptic reframing that Jesus is launching with these parables.
Okay, break that down.
You have to look at the explosive political aspirations of the day. The religious elite, the zealots, and many everyday people were desperate for a militant political messiah.
They wanted action.
They wanted a military commander who would violently overthrow the Roman occupation and establish an immediate temporal physical kingdom right then and there.
So what does this all mean? They wanted swords. They wanted an army to march on Jerusalem and kick the Romans out.
Precisely. But Jesus challenges all of those explosive political aspirations by declaring himself not a military general, but the divine sower.
Nah.
In doing so, he is completely redefining Jewish identity in this moment. He's teaching them that the kingdom of heaven is already present, but it is not arriving with a massive violent army.
Which brings us to the parables of the mustard seed in the East.
Yeah.
Because if you are a zealot, sharpening a sword in a cave, waiting for the revolution, and a rabbi tells you the kingdom of God is like a mustard seed.
It's almost offensive.
Yeah. That has to sound almost absurd, right?
It sounds like apathetic madness to a revolutionary. But let's look at the mechanism of the yeast parable. Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into about 60 pounds of flour until it worked all through the dough.
Mm.
Yeast is not a sword. It is a microscopic agent introduced into the dough. It works invisibly, subversively, beneath the surface. You cannot fight yeast with a sword.
Right. You can't arrest yeast.
Exactly. It permeates everything until the whole batch is completely transformed. He is saying the kingdom is growing secretly, which is actually a far more profound threat to the Roman demand for absolute visible submission.
That makes the parables of the hidden treasure and the pearl of great price hit so much harder.
Oh, definitely.
Like, look at Matthew 13.44. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field.
Sold everything.
Everything. To buy into this subversive, invisible kingdom, it requires the intense joy of giving up absolutely everything for something no one else can even see yet.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you start to see why this spiritual reframing was such a direct threat to the entrenched power structures.
Because it bypassed them.
Yes. Think about the parables of the weeds among the wheat and the net. In both of these, Jesus makes it clear that the final judgment, the separation of good and evil, is reserved for the end of the age, the final harvest.
Why does that specific timeline matter so much politically? Like, why the end of the age?
Because of the mechanism of delaying judgment. The religious leaders of the day, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, they derive their power from being the immediate purity police.
Oh, I see.
They wanted to pull up the weeds right now. They wanted to judge, condemn, and separate the righteous from the sinners immediately.
But Jesus says, wait.
Right. By explicitly pushing the harvest to the end of the age, Jesus is actively stripping the current temporal religious leaders of their authority to judge people right now.
Oh.
He is telling them, you don't get to pull up the weeds. If you try, you'll uproot the wheat.
Wow. He is entirely bypassing the political elite. He's rendering their temporal power irrelevant, basically telling them their authority is completely obsolete in the grand scheme of the true kingdom.
And the authorities understand just enough of the dog whistle to realize that their authority is being fundamentally undermined by this traveling rabbi from Nazareth.
But, and this is where it gets really tragic. This profound threat to the power structures didn't just anger the religious elite in Judea. It actually alienated the people who were closest to him.
Yeah.
Because the chapter ends with Jesus taking this radical subversive teaching back home.
Back to his hometown of Nazareth.
And you would naturally assume that out of all the places in Galilee, the people who watched him grow up, who knew his family, would be the most receptive soil for this message.
You'd think they would be his biggest supporters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But tragically, the source text shows he is met with staggering unbelief and rejection.
This raises an important question, and it perfectly ties the end of the chapter back to its beginning. Nazareth itself becomes the ultimate tragic example of the parable of the sower.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Jesus is the divine sower, scattering the seed of this revolutionary kingdom message. And his own hometown proved to be the hard soil.
The path.
Right. The seed of the message simply could not take root there because their familiarity bred contempt. They couldn't see past the carpenter's son to recognize the divine sower standing right in front of them.
It's a devastating parallel.
Yeah.
The religious elite in Judea rejected the message out of an arrogant desire to preserve their own power.
Mm.
And his hometown rejected him out of familiar unbelief. But the result was exactly the same. Both groups missed the hidden treasure entirely.
And both groups found themselves on the wrong side of that theological condemnation we talked about at the beginning. By demanding reality strictly on their own terms, whether that was a militant messiah with a sword,
yeah,
or just the local boy they thought they had figured out, they actively deafened themselves to the actual secrets of the kingdom.
We have covered so much incredible ground today. From the unpardonable accusation of the Beelzebub controversy, to the brilliant tactical shift of speaking in an acoustic dog whistle, to the crushing economic reality of Roman Vectigalia that made a hundredfold yield a vision of absolute liberation.
It's a lot to take in.
It really is. You really can't read these parables as just nice little agricultural stories anymore. They are a profound, deeply subversive reframing of power, economics, and divine justice.
They absolutely are. It stands as one of the most masterful, complex pedagogical pivots in recorded history.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to mull over, something that builds directly on what we've unpacked from these sources. We talked about how these parables served as a theological condemnation that actively concealed truth from the arrogant religious elite. If that is true, What does it mean for the nature of power itself?
That's a great question.
Consider the ultimate historical fate of those entrenched leaders. Does holding on to entrenched power, by its very nature, deafen a person to revolutionary truths? Does the desperate desire to maintain control leave the poorest, starving, economically crushed peasants as the only ones actually capable of holding the keys to the kingdom?
Wow.
It's a staggering thought about who really has ears to hear.
It's a profound question, and one that the historical text forces us to grapple with even today.
All right, we want to hear from you. Please drop a comment below with your thoughts on today's intense historical drama. Did understanding the suffocating economic context and the Roman taxes change how you view the parable of the sower?
Let us know.
Yeah, let us know. Also, please make sure to like and subscribe if you enjoyed today's deep dive. It really helps us bring you more of this kind of content.
And don't forget to check the description below for exclusive links and more information on the historical sources we used today.
Thanks for joining us. We will see you next time. And trust me, the next episode will be even more intense.